My name is Richard Hill. Welcome to the seventh edition of the Monthly Labor Report, in which we examine the latest developments on the labor front, as usual with the help of Michael Zweig, economist, labor historian, and founder of the Center for the Study of Working Class Life at the State University of New York at Stony Brook, where he taught for many years. Michael is a union activist and author of many articles and several books, including The Working Class Majority, America's Best Kept Secret, and his just published Race, Class, and Gender, Challenging the Injuries and Divisions of Capitalism. Michael, it's great to have you here.
It's great to be with you once again.
Yeah.
Every month, the first Tuesday of the month.
That's correct. And this is the seventh time we've done this, so we're accumulating a bit of an archive of labor talks. Well, Michael, I'm going to turn it right over to you so you can introduce this evening's topic and our special guest.
Well, we are each month talking about some of the more important and noteworthy developments in the labor movement in the U.S. And I think that one of the most important and telling and significant developments is a rising tide within the labor movement to express opposition to the slaughter in Gaza and the demand for ceasefire. And that effort within the labor movement was really initiated by several unions, but in particular by the United Electrical Workers, whose president is Carl Rosen, and also United Food and Commercial Workers, Local 3000 out in Washington State, led by Faye Gunter. And that's a 50,000-member local of grocery store workers and other related people out on the Pacific Northwest. So that petition and that statement has now garnered well over 150. I don't know where it is, but we're so glad that Carl Rosen, the president of the United Electrical Workers, one of the initiators of this statement, can be with us tonight. And so, Carl, we wanted to hear from you as to exactly what is going on with that petition, what motivated it, how it's going, what resistance there is to it, and how you in the labor movement are challenging that resistance and bringing so many people into the labor camp against the war in Gaza.
Hi, thanks for having me, Richard and Michael. Good to be on with you, Mike. We've obviously done a lot of work together over the years, and I think this is kind of a continuation of some of that work that was done over 20 years ago with U.S. Labor Against the War. What's interesting is actually we've been able to ramp up a labor support for a ceasefire position, for an end-the-war position, in many ways much quicker this time around, including leading to a statement by the AFL-CIO in favor of a ceasefire, something that took several years in the case of the war in Iraq that Bush II initiated on totally false pretenses, essentially. And so it's a good sign that the labor movement has learned something from the past mistakes of U.S. foreign policy. It didn't happen immediately, even here. I mean, you know, for a couple reasons. Number one, you know, obviously what Hamas did on October 7th was a horrible thing, and nobody wanted to be seen as in some way justifying that. The old saying is very true, two wrongs don't make a right. And it became apparent pretty quickly that the current extreme right-wing militarist government in Israel was going to make use of what happened in order to carry out an agenda they apparently had been wanting to carry out for a while in terms of forcing a large number of Palestinians out of most of Gaza and, you know, indiscriminately killing many people in the course of it. So when it became clear that was happening within days, frankly, our union realized that we needed to say something. And the peace movement is not nearly as organized as it was 20 years ago or 25 years ago or certainly 45 years ago. It's waned a lot in this country. So if something was going to happen you know, somebody was going to have to step up in labor and make it happen. We weren't going to be able to have somebody else helping build it for us. And so we had conversations with a couple folks around about, you know, what can we do? And, you know, we were asked if we would initiate an online sign-on petition by unions calling for a ceasefire. Basically said, let's get at least one other union of real substance on there with us as a starting point. It's always better to start out as a coalition already, even if it's only a coalition of two. And fortunately, UFCW Local 3000 was quickly located, and you know, we agreed to jointly launch it. Readily agreed on fairly basic language fairly quickly, where the main point is getting to a ceasefire now is what's needed. Other things can be sorted out later. And, you know, of course, calling for release of the hostages and humanitarian aid as part of it. So we got that up, and it quickly caught on. Fortunately, some of the folks who helped with U.S. Labor Against the War years ago, you know, still have lists, et cetera, and we're able to amplify it and get it around, and it started spreading pretty quickly. And it took a little bit of time, but not that long, for some other national unions to come forward. The Postal Worker Union, APWU, Mark Dimenstein, president, did a nice job of lifting it up. In fact, Mark, you know, really took the issue right into the AFL-CIO last fall or early winter. Didn't have a lot of support there at that time, but as things played out over time, people came to realize that he was right in having raised it in the first place. And, you know, by the time the AFL-CIO endorsed it, we had actually had either sign-ons to this statement, you know, which made it easy for people, for unions to sign on without having to write their own statement, or unions that did, in fact, draft their own statement, generally along the same lines, you know, but with their own wording and, you know, emphasizing the things important to their unions. We had those statements from unions that represented literally more than half of the entire union membership in the country. I think we're north of 9 million workers in unions that have endorsed the statement at this point. And what's especially important about it is that this was done even though there's a Democratic administration in power, because historically, labor unions and many social justice organizations and peace organizations have been a little less quick to criticize American foreign policy when it's a Democrat in office. And so it was, you know, in some ways easier to come out against the war in Iraq when it was, you know, Bush in office. And usually a Democrat is given more of a benefit of the doubt for a longer period. But not this time around. And frankly, unfortunately, our, you know, current occupant of the White House is really, you know, made very serious errors in giving free rein to an Israeli government that has no concerns for anybody other than themselves.
Let me just insert here that this is WPKN in Bridgeport, 89.5 FM, and streaming online at WPKN.org. Mike, did you have something?
Well, my union, which is an AFT local, represents 37,000 people teaching and working at the State University of New York. We are in the process of negotiating among ourselves and with our leadership a resolution criticizing the war in Gaza and calling for a ceasefire. And we have our statewide delegate assembly 3 weeks from now, and we expect to be able to pass this resolution and join in with the rest of the labor movement. And it's just, in our case, it involves real discussion with our members. It's not just a few people sitting in a room at the leadership level and saying this, let's do that, and then the membership isn't involved. And I know that in the UE and in many other unions and locals, that culture exists where this becomes a real question of political education. rather than just a few people saying, okay, let's do this, and then the membership really doesn't know anything about it. So I'm just wondering, Carl, if you could say something about what the experience is in bringing this question to the rank-and-file workers in UE or in other unions in, as you've been building this campaign. And also, if you could tell us how many locals and union organizations have already signed on and where people can go to find that petition and that statement to sign on.
Sure. The reason UE was able to move quickly on this is because we essentially already had a stated position of the union adopted by delegates to our convention, calling for all the things that are in that petition. Frankly, there's been need for a ceasefire for quite a while. Israel, at a much smaller scale, has been attacking with the military, with settler violence, etc., Palestinians in both Gaza and the West Bank for quite some time. So UE has had a long history of discussion about the issues in the Middle East, and it eventually developed into a resolution or part of our overall resolution on foreign policy, our peace and jobs resolution, basically, that we've adopted some version of every 2 years at our national convention. It's well discussed amongst the delegates there, who are all rank-and-file members coming from locals across the country. That discussion itself is a form of political education, but it also makes sure, obviously, that you know what we pass to be the policy of UE, and you can see the UE policy if you go to our website at ueunion.org, ueunion.org. But that gets there because of that discussion that takes place, and these are based on resolutions that are submitted by locals. And we've gradually, you know, strengthened that resolution in terms of its criticism of, you know, blindfolded U.S. support of Israel, as the Israeli policy has gotten worse and worse and worse over the recent decades. And in fact, it got to the point that several years ago, we actually endorsed the BDS movement, the Boycott and Divest movement, which is similar to what was done with apartheid South Africa to bring apartheid to the end in South Africa. So we already were on record saying we needed to stop U.S. military support for Israel, that Israel needed to, you know, pull back from areas that they had taken away from the Palestinians to, you know, continued expansion of settlements, etc., need for much greater humanitarian support. All of those things were already in our policy, and we had happened to have a union convention in September. And we discussed the policy again and passed it with, boy, I'm not sure there was any opposition. And there were a number of members who got up and spoke to it and spoke to the need for labor solidarity with the Palestinians and recognizing the injustice there. So that made it easy for us then as national officers to sign the union on to the public statement, because it was what we already had. Now, other unions many of them went through very different processes in terms of adopting it. And they, you know, every union has its own needs and requirements on it. So some of them had extensive discussion within their executive boards. Some issued officer statements, and some, you know, at the local level, there were membership meetings that adopted them. There have been unions, particularly like, say, for example, graduate worker unions. Some of them have done it by referendum. So it really depends on the union what process they used. But generally, something like this does not get adopted unless there's a feeling of real support. And what's most interesting, and we've also heard this from the national unions that have come on board, is how little pushback there has been on it. That they, you know, there's been some hesitancy, that they're afraid that, you know, they'll catch some flack from within their unions on it, and they aren't, because, you know, people can see with their eyes that what is happening to Gaza is just an atrocity that no civilized person should tolerate.
Carl, this is Richard. I just wanted to follow up on that, and also on Michael's explication of the way UFT is dealing with this in terms of getting membership support. And by membership, I think we need to distinguish between delegates and actual rank and file. I mean, I think we've been possibly using those terms interchangeably today. But a little bit deeper into the process by which UE, and as you said, each union does it differently, but was there a sort of a bottom-up discussion before the delegates wanted to sign on to this, or how did that work?
So So the way things work in our union, so first of all, I would dispute your saying that there's a difference between rank and file and delegates. The delegates in UE are all rank and file members. Probably 98% of them work full-time in the shop. We have very few locals that have any full-time officers, but even those, they're people who are in and out of the shop. You know, they're up for election every year or 2 years, and they might be returned to the shop. They might be continuing in office. They're still drawing exactly the same salary, you know, same wages as they were earning in the shop. And that's a less than 2%. We don't have staff serving as delegates. We don't have in UE, we don't have, you know, high paid officers of any sort. This is a rank and file convention. And once the National Convention passes a resolution, it becomes our policy for the next 2 years. And within that, there is the leeway then for the national officers to sign on to things on behalf of the union that are consistent with that policy. If it's an area that's fully new, but something that develops between conventions, then we go to our general executive board, which is made up of 19 people, 16 of them whom are people who work, you know, full-time in various workplaces around the country. They come together three times a year or more if needed, and they're our highest decision-making body between conventions. They can sign us on or issue statements of their own. You'll see on our website general executive board statements on things that are new that have come up in between conventions. But we always, whatever's done then is also then brought to the following convention for further ratification, solidification as our policy.
Yeah.
Two things. If you could let us know, Carl, how people can sign on to this, because it's not
sure.
Just union.
Thank you.
Unions, but individual members, I think there's also a way. And
yeah.
Then I'm just wondering, we have in our union, which is not UFT, that's the teachers' union in New York City, but
right.
Ours is for the State University of New York's United University Professions. Our delegates, just as yours are, Carl, are all workers who come
right.
out of the schools. Nobody is there as a paid staff person, and our paid staff and labor relations specialists have nothing to do with the policy of the union. They don't vote. They're not engaged in the debate. It really is up to the members. But I wanted to ask in that regard if you could just say something about why it's union business. In our union, there is a debate. There is pushback, and the pushback is, wait a minute, why are we even talking about this? It has nothing to do with terms and conditions of employment. It has nothing to do with the contract, and that's what the union is for. And if you want to be against the war, fine, go be against the war, but don't bring it in here because it just divides the membership. So I think that if you could let us know where
sure.
people can get sign on and
yep.
how that question emerges and what it is that you have to say to that, I think it would be helpful for people
sure.
listening in.
And when you answer that, Carl, are we talking now about union members or general public?
So what we have in terms of people signing on is for union members to sign on in particular. It's the website that it now resides at. For a long time, it was just an Action Network type sign-on, but we now have set up a website under the name National Labor Network for Ceasefire. And so the website itself you can find at laborforceasefire.org, Labor for Ceasefire, and that's F-O-R spelled out, Labor for Ceasefire. Ceasefire is one word, .org. And you can read the statement, you can sign on, you can see a list of some of the many unions that have endorsed this. You can see all of the national unions are listed fairly high up that have signed on. And there's also links to other statements, some of whom are unions that haven't signed this particular statement, but that have issued their own. So, for example, the AFT, which Mike's local is part of, has actually at this point issued a statement of itself, which is quite a remarkable feat given the history they've had in terms of foreign policy. Now, why is this a labor issue? This is a labor issue because for many reasons. Number one, there are Palestinian unions who have called for solidarity. Their members are getting killed. Their members are not being allowed to go to work because normally they would have to, you know, many of the jobs that they work at because Gaza's been strangled and the West Bank has been strangled, economically as well as militarily. Most of their jobs are actually in Israel. They haven't been being allowed to go there and do that work. So the trade unions in amongst the Palestinians have been calling for solidarity, number one. Number two, there's a deep belief in the labor movement that what solidarity means is an injury to one is an injury to all. We can't look away from injustice anyplace. In addition, this is part of the militarized U.S. foreign policy. The money that's going into this, I mean, there's a tremendous amount of U.S. Military spending that's going into this. It's just, you know, dumping these bombs. This is U.S.-made ordnance, and it's paid for by the U.S. This is money that could instead be going to meet actual human needs. And the working class has a lot of unmet needs in this country. When you look at the lack of housing, when you look at the need to improve all kinds of public services, better paid jobs, improving the environment, all of those things need the funds that are instead are being poured down the rat hole of military spending that not only does not improve things, but it's actually obviously totally destructive. So all of those things, you know, this was a debate during the Vietnam War, and look where that got us, that most of the labor movement spent most of the Vietnam War on the wrong side or silent. And it was only in the very last years of the Vietnam War that some sizable segment of the labor movement came out against the war. And that was in part because of the returning veterans who realized what a terrible thing it was. And they were now in these workplaces and weren't going to put up with their unions continuing to allow this to be done in the name of the American people. This is true with any social justice issue. I mean, it would be easy, you know, to criticize unions getting involved in many different issues that are very important, that the labor movement takes the lead, whether it's stuff that is a fairly direct impact at a workplace, like working to make sure that, you know, the fight for a 40-hour work week, and we really should be fighting now, you know, to legislate a 35-hour work week or less, but also, you know, broader things like making sure that it's illegal to have discrimination, et cetera. There's been arguments in the labor movement before, oh, no, we should just stick to bread and butter, our own contract, and we shouldn't be working on anything beyond that. Labor unions need to stand up for the working class, and they need to stand up for the working class not only in the U.S. but throughout the world, because when workers are driven down into abject poverty elsewhere, it drives down the standards in our country, because our employers not only threaten to move to those other countries, they actually do move to those other countries, and we lose those jobs. And the workers in those countries might have the jobs, but under far worse conditions, and usually under repressive political conditions because of U.S. military support for very backwards governments in those countries.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce you both. I'm here with on the Monthly Labor Report with our resident economist and labor historian, Michael Zweig, and our special guest tonight, Carl Rosen, General President of the United Electrical Radio and Machine Workers Union, or UE. And Carl, why don't you take this moment to mention again that site where people can go to sign the petition?
Sure. laborforceasefire.org. So that's labor, then 4-F-O-R, ceasefire.org. And you can find lots of information there. And if you are a union member, including information you can take in order to have the kind of discussion in your union that Mike talked about having in his local.
Carl, before you know, we move on to maybe talking about some of the hot-button things that have popped up in the past month that Michael's going to review for us, I wanted to ask you a little bit about, if you could talk a little about the history of UE. I just want to mention on a personal note that when I was, oh, I don't know, in my early 20s or maybe late teens, I encountered a book called Labor's Untold Story, and I read it avidly. It was so exciting, you know, hearing about these labor battles that took place in the middle of the 19th century. And the history of labor struggle in this country was so vividly spelled out. And when I looked, I said, where'd this book come from? Well, I saw on the title page, United Electrical Workers. So can you tell us a little bit about the history of your union and, you know, how it took up this fight to be really in the forefront of progressive struggles in this country?
sure. And that book continues to be in print because UE keeps it in print. You can get copies of it through our national office if you go to our website, ueunion.org, ueunion.org. You can get information on how to get that book at a very low price because we do want people to read it and know that history. But look, it's not that UE came to this position at some point in our history. We were born with this position in the 1930s, as were many of the other CIO unions. We were an original CIO union in 1936, and you know, we represented the workers throughout the electrical industry, just like the auto workers for the auto industry and steel workers for the steel industry. Although we were built very much from the bottom up, it was some independent unions that had self-organized in different large electrical parts company plants, and then they came together to form a national union to organize the whole industry. And we had a very left militant perspective, as did most of the other CIO unions. The McCarthy era was foisted upon us in order to destroy that, and it was unfortunately very effective, and many of the unions decided to go along to get along. 11 unions said, no, we're going to continue to stand by our principles of, among other things, political independence on the part of the labor movement, not tied to any particular party, and certainly not tied to U.S. foreign policy. Of those 11 unions that tried to stay the course, 9 were literally destroyed and within a few years no longer existed. 2 survived, UE and the West Coast Longshore, and ever since then we've been the 2 that have been known as the most, generally the most democratic, the most militant, taken leading roles on all kinds of issues, and particularly on issues around foreign policy in opposition to the Vietnam War from very early, et cetera. And we would argue that, in fact, one of the core reasons that they launched the McCarthy era against the labor movement was because we wanted an independent position on foreign policy and have one that supported workers throughout the world rather than supporting American corporations throughout the world. We lost that political argument in the 1940s and 50s, and the U.S. working class has been paying a heavy price for it ever since, because basically U.S. foreign policy became one of using military, political, and economic devices to make the rest of the world safe for American corporations to move our jobs overseas and make sure that the working and living standards in those other countries be very low so that those corporations could make extra money. Ah. And we've paid that price ever since, and we've got a long way to go before we come back around the corner on that.
Mike, would you like to weigh in on this?
Well, we've talked on this show before about that history of the crushing of the left and the significant role that socialist and communist movements in the 30s played in organizing the CIO unions and then influencing the AFL unions, too, the American Federation of Labor. So the story that Carl tells is a story that continues to this day, where there is a dedicated, urgent campaign on the part of corporate leadership in this country to destroy unions. They're not done. And even mild unions, you know, they want to crush. And so I think that we need to pay attention to how it is that that sort of class struggle continues, and the need for unions and for working people to organize a militant, solid resistance to that. You know, and if we want to talk about, you know, maybe bridge over to some of the things that are going on right now in the labor movement, of course, we had the UAW contract last fall, which was really a terrific victory. We've talked about that on this show before. But that is leading to organizing campaigns in the South, particularly targeting Toyota and Tesla and Honda and VW and the VW plant in Chattanooga. But something very interesting is going on, both from Tesla and also from Amazon. They are going into court to say that the National Labor Relations Board does not have the authority to regulate collective bargaining, because the Congress didn't specifically say that they could do X, Y, and Z to discipline business and to give leadership and give openings to labor. And so what Amazon and Tesla are doing incidentally, who are owned by the two richest men in the world, they are going in and they're saying that this is an agency that really shouldn't have legislative authority, just like the claim is that the Environmental Protection Agency shouldn't have authority to make decisions about what's a wetland. If the Congress wants to say that something is a wetland, let them say it. If they don't say it, then the administrative agencies can't say it on behalf of the environment or on behalf of labor or on behalf of financial institutions. And that is a very dangerous challenge. So the story that Carl is telling about the desire on the part of capital to crush unions from the 30s because they were militant, they're not done. They want to crush unions even if they aren't militant, because they don't want anybody challenging their power and their authority. And this sort of major questions doctrine, which has now come up, and the Supreme Court has ruled that the Environmental Protection Agency does not have authority on major questions, and they've blocked EPA regulations. Now, my goodness, they're now going after the NLRB to stop unions from organizing in Amazon, to stop unions from organizing Tesla auto plants. So we are done with this class struggle, and I think the story that Carl is telling is a very important one for the whole labor movement, and I'm just delighted that we could have Carl with us here today.
Indeed. Carl, unless you have any other thoughts, I'll move it forward, and you can stick with us if you have the time.
Oh, hang on. This is an interesting discussion.
Absolutely. So I just wanted to read a note. I guess this is from an article that I noticed, I think, in the Guardian newspaper. In an unexpected political convergence, Sean O'Brien, the president of the Teamsters Union, announced that he had met privately with Donald Trump, raising questions about who the Teamsters will endorse in 2024 and drawing anger from the union's progressive members. Would either of you care to comment about that?
Well, I'll just say, and maybe Carl has some insights from the top leadership of the AFL can comment too, but I do think that Sean O'Brien led a very important and militant operation in confronting UPS last year. And he doesn't fool around on behalf of his members and on behalf of working people. So he met with Trump. Well, you know, the guy's running for president. You try to sort it out and see what he's asked to say. I think a more significant indicator is that the Teamsters gave $45,000 to the Republican National Committee, to the RNC.
There you go.
So that's a real material plus. But the Teamsters haven't made a decision about who they're going to support in this campaign, and I don't think we should sort of get our hair on fire and think it's all a done deal just because Sean O'Brien has met with Trump. We'll have to see how that plays out.
Carl, any thoughts on that?
I have no specific knowledge. I mean, it's certainly true that a number of unions, including the Teamsters, over the years have tried to at least make both parties be somewhat responsive to them by not giving an early endorsement, but instead by working both sides to some extent. And it is probably true that there are a good number of Teamster members who are Republicans and supporters of Trump, and it's in no small part because the Democratic Party has not done a good enough job of addressing the needs of the working class. And folks remember things like NAFTA passing with a Democratic president, and you know, that undermined an awful lot of American jobs. And those are a lot of people who no longer have union jobs and have other really crappy jobs, especially in rural areas where unions have almost disappeared because of the jobs being moved out of the country. And unions were one of the few places where people came together and got some political education other than what the right wing is putting out there. And the Democratic Party has virtually disappeared from all of those areas.
Mm-hmm.
And it's their own doing.
So, Michael, maybe this might be a time to look at some of the bullet points that have come up recently. I noticed one the other day was that Starbucks, the unions that have organized at Starbucks, are now affiliated with a national union. There seems to be a breakthrough in terms of the contract negotiations that had been sort of stalled because the CEO had demanded that they all be done in a sort of fragmented way, and now that there's some kind of centralization on the table.
It's a very interesting story from the top and from below. The CEO, Howard Schultz, up until about a year ago, was absolutely dedicated to crushing unions, and he kept saying there is no way that I will ever recognize any union, and he was vicious in his attacks. And then he left, and a new CEO came in. That culture of anti-union activity remained, but the new CEO was more sensitive to the public outcry around the country and public support for Starbucks workers. More and more Starbucks outlets have organized, and so this new CEO has led Starbucks into a slightly different direction, where he seems to be now willing to entertain national level negotiations. Well, we'll see. And, you know, it's one step, but there are not actually negotiations going on. There is no progress towards a contract, neither at a specific Starbucks nor nationally. So, yeah, it's an interesting development, but there's a long, long way to go with that.
Okay. Any other news that you wanted to share, Michael, on the labor front?
Well, I thought that this UAW story that I was mentioning before, and the way that they're going after this is Tesla, and not just the UAW, but Amazon too, going after the National Labor Relations Board authority and saying that it's just unconstitutional, is really quite an important development. I really think we need to look out for it. But while we were talking about the Teamsters, they just had two very important, successful contracts. They had a contract dispute with Anheuser-Busch. 5,000 workers just got a contract and gave a 23% wage increase over 5 years. And they significantly ended the two-tier health system, where it used to be that the company got concessions and the new hires were given a much worse health coverage than the existing employees. That ended. And so that's a very important success. And that also ended in the UAW contracts. They ended that two-tier system. So that is another indication of strength in the labor movement. And in the Teamsters, they also got a new contract for about 14,000 clerical and skilled trades workers all through the California State University system. Now, these aren't teachers or graduate students. These are the clerical and skilled trades workers all throughout the Cal State system. And that was a tough battle. And they got a new contract, and 80% of the membership, more than 80% of the membership of the local, voted. And of those who voted, 91% voted yes. So that was a contract success that really was grounded in the mobilization of the members, and they were satisfied with it. And I know that UE is doing a lot of work organizing around the country, and maybe Carl can tell us the latest news for what UE is about.
Sure. We've organized 30,000 workers, mostly graduate workers at different research universities over less than the last 2 years, actually. And the reason we're able to organize at that scale is we're making use of worker-to-worker organizing. This is not a staff model of organizing. And, you know, our labor movement, our modern labor movement, was not built originally. In the 1930s, it was workers organizing workers. It's the model we have to return to in order to organize at the kind of scale we need to literally organize tens and tens of millions of workers in order to get labor membership back up into the 30, 40, 50% of the workforce to have, you know, real sway over what working conditions and living conditions are like in this country. So we're glad it's working for us. You know, what you mentioned about the Starbucks workers, that's been a worker-to-worker organizing model also, which is how, you know, they've been able to organize at literally hundreds of different workplaces. Wouldn't have been possible if you had to have a regular organizing drive with a staff person assigned, you know, full-time to each one of those locations, et cetera. There just aren't enough organizers in the labor movement. So this worker-to-worker approach is great. We're glad that we've been able to really show a strong model on it, and we only wish that a lot more of the labor movement would pick it up because, success begets success, and when any unions are successful, it helps all the others. Certainly a lot of folks are getting much better contracts right now because of the kind of fight that the Teamsters did at UPS, that the auto workers did with the big three auto companies. Right in the middle of it, we had a long and strong strike at a big locomotive plant that UE represents in Erie. All of these things, they help give confidence to workers that they, if they fight, they can win. And when you have that, it continues to spread and build on itself.
You know, let me say something about this worker-to-worker model, which I think is so important. One of the things that the company always says is, we don't need a union in here. That's just a third party. That's just somebody coming in to put themselves between the workers and management. We just think we ought to deal directly with the workers. And the workers should deal directly with us. We don't need this third party. If you've got worker-to-worker organizing, the union is the workers. It's not some third party. It's not some staff person from far away who's coming in just to hang out for the organizing campaign and then go negotiate the contract without the members. This member-to-member organizing is essential to break that story. And what we see in the U.S. now is that unions are very much in favor. There's something like 65% of the American people in the American workforce that is favorably disposed towards unions. But only 10% are in unions. So why is it that people are so favorably disposed towards unions, but they're not in them, is because of very stiff management opposition. And that opposition often involves violations of labor law. And the companies want to be able to continue those violations. And the only way to stop it is to just have that kind of member-to-member organizing where the workers themselves are dedicated and committed to making the union happen and become the union and don't just sit back and wait for the organizer to come in from somewhere else and say, okay, this is what we're going to do. That's the key. Is that member-to-member, real bottom-up organizing that the UE has championed since its beginnings almost 100 years ago.
Fantastic, Michael. And just before we end, maybe we could circle back to the question of Gaza. And if either or both of you would like to weigh in on how you think this issue is going to affect the presidential politics that are looming ever closer and causing much agita on the part of progressives all over the country and probably all over the world. Do either of you have an opinion on how the Biden administration's stance on Gaza and its behavior, actually, on Gaza is going to affect his presidential prospects?
It's Biden loses the election. I think the analysis is going to be that this is the issue that fully did him in. I mean, there's a lot of other shortcomings, gut problems, not the least being his age, obviously, and the way that's being played up through the media, et cetera, and by his opponent, obviously. But you can look directly at voting populations that are turning against him exactly because of his continued support for mass killing in Gaza. And that is amongst the Arab community, the Muslim community in this country. And you saw that reflected in a substantial number of people voting uncommitted in Michigan. I was just watching political pundits tonight saying he's probably going to lose Michigan. He's got to pick up another state. They're looking for other states he can pick up in exchange for it. I mean, there's no way that he should lose Michigan under normal circumstances. This is political malpractice that he's put himself in that shape. But it's also young people. And again, that's also in Michigan. There's a lot of universities, et cetera. The younger generation has no tolerance for what's going on there. They are not stuck in a Cold War mentality. I mean, that's Biden's problem. He's still stuck in a Cold War mentality where Israel was our, guard dog in the Middle East in taking on, Soviet-influenced governments, basically. And, you know, he's stuck in that past. And it's to the tremendous detriment of himself politically. And unfortunately, we're all going to pay the price for that. So I would say it's no small part of the reason that a good number of unions have come out pushing for a change in a policy, because they know that he's losing votes amongst their members because of this. And so they're really trying to tell him he's got to shift on this. And there have been some shifts. And I think, you know, given that the vice president came out with a pretty strong demand for a ceasefire over the weekend, I don't think that was accidental. This is reflecting the fact that they're realizing that they've got a problem here, and they need to find a way to shift course. But, boy, their head has been stuck so deep in the sand for so long, it's hard.
My agita did not decrease after that commentary, Carl. Michael, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, so I think that the uncommitted vote also includes a lot of young Jews. A lot of Jewish people, particularly young, are really not eager to be associated, because they're Jews, with what the Zionist Israeli state is doing. And to conflate those two and to say, oh, anybody who opposes Israel is an anti-Semite, I think there's a lot of young Jews who are saying, wait, that's not true. I'm not an anti-Semite. I'm against mass murder. And I oppose these policies. And I think that there is a lot of sentiment bubbling up among the Jewish population, where we see people joining in with Not In My Name and also Jewish Voice for Peace. The problem that Biden has, I think, is a serious one. But when it really comes down to the vote, not the primary, but the actual vote in November, it's hard to see that those people who are upset with him will think that Trump is a better alternative. Because Trump is just horrible when it comes to issues of Islam, issues of Middle East, and Israeli power in that area. So Trump is not going to get any of those votes. I think some of those people who are voting uncommitted in the primary will stay home. They're just never going to vote for Biden. It doesn't matter. They're just going to stay home. Or they'll vote for down-ballot people. But there's a lot of Republicans who will never vote for Trump, and they'll stay home. So I think what's going to be interesting is to see which candidate, Trump or Biden, has more people stay home. And that's what more or less is going to determine the outcome of this election. So that's where I think this is going.
Such, talk about a proverbial race to the bottom.
Yeah. such is the state of our democracy, my God. Who gets the most people to stay home?
Yeah, that's right. That's the person that's who's going to lose. It's just weird what the country has come to and what dysfunction we get when there's raw corporate power and raw fascistic developments, real fascism that's brewing in this country. It's a serious, serious problem. And I know that UE and some other people in the labor movement and myself, I've been working with it too, to develop within the political climate of this country a labor voice, a real working class voice against this fascism that's brewing. We cannot have it that Lynn Cheney is going to be the champion of the anti-fascist movement in the United States. And they just can't imagine what that would mean in taking the whole country to the right into a terrible position on labor issues and on women's issues and on all kinds of stuff, voting rights, you name it. And so I think the work that we're doing in the labor movement around organizing and also around Gaza and raising consciousness about all this stuff is part of a campaign to really understand the nature of power that we're dealing with and how to confront it with a working class base and a working class voice.
Well, I want to thank both of you for a vibrant and exciting conversation tonight. Carl Rosen, General President of the United Electrical Workers Union, UE, and Michael Zweig, Professor Emeritus from the State University of New York at Stony Brook, author of many books, including his most recent, Race, Class, and Gender, Challenging the Injuries and Divisions of Capitalism. Thank you both so very much for being here on the seventh edition of the Monthly Labor Report. And we'll go out with a little bit of more Pete Seeger talking union, that iconic song from the 1940s, probably. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
To listen when the union talks, he'd better be mighty lonely. Everybody decide to walk out on him. Suppose the working you so hard it's just outrageous, and they're paying you all starvation wages. You go to the boss and the boss would yell, before I raise your pay, I'd see you all in hell. Well, he's puffing a big cigar, feeling...